Thank you very much for coming, and thank Rabbi Hidari for inviting me. I gave a lecture series, I think a few months ago, on Islam, and I gave a similar lecture last week, Ohev David and Shlomo. Well, same topic, but the material will be a little bit different. And when I was asked at that time to give a lecture, I pleaded my way out of giving another lecture on Islam, because it gets to be a rather down subject, especially in light of what's going on in the world. I wanted to speak about the Hebrew language. And really, to speak about the Hebrew language, as you'll see by the end of the session, will necessitate really more than one evening. Because I'm going to divide my lecture into at least three sections. The first section will be a picture of language in general. The second section will be a picture of the Semitic languages. And the third section will be an overall picture of the history of the Hebrew language, and then more specifics on the pre-biblical sound of Hebrew and the biblical sound of Hebrew, and with some examples of quite a few examples from the Quran. If you have any questions along the way, please stop me. When we get to the proper point in the lecture, I have some material to distribute, which we're going to look at together. You know, people try to imagine, when did language begin? We have in the world today, whether we're talking about 2005 or in the recorded history of humankind, there have been approximately 4,000 languages on the face of the earth. I don't mean dialects. I mean actual languages. Some languages are spoken by more than a billion people, such as Chinese. Other languages are spoken by no more than several thousand people. But what constitutes a language is a sufficient amount of lexical material, a grammar that's rather unique, and a morphology, a structure, which differentiates it from its nearest neighbor and constitutes not a dialect, but a language. Now, when did language begin? When did spoken language begin? It's a question that... It's a question that's asked not only by linguists, but also by anthropologists. And why do anthropologists ask that question? They ask that question very simply because they want to know at what point in the human physiological development was language possible. And the answer really is that you have to have a brain, needless to say. You have to have a voice box capable of making a wide variety of sounds, and you also have to have a mandible over here that allows you to open your mouth sufficiently to allow for a wide variety of sounds, and not only an alphabetic sound, but also a vocalic sound. And the physical structure of man, based upon the skeletal remains, would point to approximately, this is a guesstimate, between 40 and 50,000 years ago, according to the scientific evidence we have today for the beginnings of language. Which means at that point, the voice box probably, the mandible, the bone structure over here, and the brain, the cranial area, was large enough for the development of a language which had a morphology, meaning a structure, a vocabulary, which means a word sufficient enough to describe the environment around one, and also human emotion. Of course, in Mikra, we find a rather simplified description of the beginning of language. And most of us know this from Sefer Bereshit, and I'll just read this just to refresh in our memory. Vayihi echol ha'aretz safa echad udvarim echadim. ויהי בנוסעם מקדם, וימצאו בקעה בארץ שנעה, וישבו שם, ויאמרו איש אל רעהו, הווה נלבנה לבני ולשרפה לשרפה, ותהי להם הלבנה לאבן, והחמר היה להם לחומר, ויאמרו הווה נבנה לנו עיר ומגדל, וראשו והשמיים ונעשה לנו שם, פן נפוץ על פני כל הארץ. וירד השם לראות את העיר ואת המגדל אשר בנו בני האדם. ויום השם הן עם אחד ושפה אחת לכולם, וזה החילם לעשות. So very simply, according to Mikra, and remember, from an historical perspective, not from a religious perspective, Mikra is not an historical book, it's not a scientific book. As I tell my students, it's not a chemistry manual, nor is it a biology manual, nor is it a manual for history. It's a religion book. So from a religion perspective now, we're getting a picture of one language, people agreeing on a certain act which was contrary to the Borei Olam, and Borei Olam comes down, and he mefitz et bnei Adam al pnei haaretz. He scatters the people across the earth. And from this scattering, according to our tradition, we find the beginning of language. Now, in a sense, we're not trying to, we don't try to correspond the Bible with science. But if we accept a scientific postulate that humanity may have begun at one point, to say that one point may have been somewhere on the east coast of Africa, and from that point humanity began to spread across the face of the earth, well, we're not too far from wrong in the biblical understanding of the beginning of language. That people began at one point, and from there languages began to develop and spread across the face of the civilized world at that time. And the civilized world at that time would constitute what is called today the Fertile Crescent area and the Nile Valley, which would be the Tigris and Euphrates region and the Nile Valley. So we have these languages developing across the face of the earth. Human beings carrying their speech patterns with them across the face of the earth. And if we look across the earth today, we find that we have languages like French, Italian, Spanish, Romanian, Russian, German, etc. And how do we characterize these languages? Well, very simply, we characterize language by family. So we have one of the largest families of languages on the face of the earth. It's called the Indo-European language family. Indo-European. And just the name itself tells us a great deal. It tells us we're speaking about Indo, India, or the Indian subcontinent, and we're speaking about Europe. So we have a vast language family which doesn't only exist today, but also existed in remote antiquity. By remote antiquity, we mean in the period, well, not only during the Abrahamic period, but probably in the pre-Abrahamic period and in the post-Abrahamic period. The most ancient Indo-European language is the Hittite language. And we know, of course, the names of at least two Hittim in Mikra. We know Uriah HaHitti, and we know Ephron HaHitti. And the names Uriah and Ephron HaHitti, you know, at least Uriah is a Semiticized name. Ephron also a Semiticized name. They lived in the Fertile Crescent. They lived in what we call Greater Syria or Syro-Palestine. And their names became Semitized. Whether their language among themselves was Semitized, that we don't know. But the Hittite language was spoken as early as 2400 approximately BCE, and certainly lasted till about 900 or 950 BCE. And their empire, the Hittite empire, was all of Asia Minor, into Syria. Sometime moving into Palestine itself, into Israel itself. One of the greatest battles, decisive battles in the ancient world, was the Battle of Kadesh between the Egyptians and the Hittites, determining who would be the master of the Fertile Crescent and controlling the trade along the Mediterranean Sea. Just to cite two words from the Hittite language that you would be interested in and relating it to English. The first one is Genu. I'll explain that in a minute. This one is rather more difficult to see the etymological relationship. And the other one is Watar, water. Now Genu is from the word genuine. And we have the word, you go to your doctor and it gives you a smack on your knee, and what kind of emotion do we have? We have a genuflex. Genuflex. Our knee moves up. And what does Yosef do with his great, with his ninim, not his grandchildren, but his great-grandchildren? He puts them on his birkayim to say they're genuine. So these are two words among many words that are from the Hittite language and move down, down, down through the centuries. And eventually, of course, the words will enter into Latin. This will enter into Latin. Of course, in Latin we have aqua. So this will go more into German, into the Germanic Indo-European languages. But Indo-European history, the language family now, is very ancient, which is what I'm trying to say. Another Indo-European language, which we're all familiar with, at least visually, is Russian. And Russian is part of what we call the Slavic Indo-European language family. So Polish is a Slavic language, Serbian, Croatian, Russian, of course, Old Church Slavonic, not Romanian, that's a Czech, Slovene, Slovak language. These are all part of the Slavic language family. Bielorussian, Ukrainian. And how far back does the Slavic languages go? Approximately in the year 850 CE, in their written stage. Whether they were spoken earlier or not, we don't know. So there's a great gap in time between the Hittite language, we're talking about the 3rd millennium BCE, in its written stage, and the earliest manifestation of the Slavic languages in their written stage. We're talking about, about 1600 years in time. A third family of Indo-European languages coming is the Germanic language family. In the Germanic language family, we all know, of course, German. We know Dutch. Pardon me?
Polish.
No, Polish is Slavic. We know Yiddish, which is part of the Germanic language family. We know Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, and Icelandic. English, too. But Icelandic is a very interesting language because the Icelandic language spoken today still preserves the same sound structure and preserves the same morphology, sentence structure, as the Vikings spoke in the 8th century CE. And one of the reasons for this is because Iceland has been a rather isolated country. So if you look at the, this were a lecture on only Indo-European languages, and you would compare the Danish vocabulary to the Icelandic vocabulary, the Danish vocabulary would have many loan words coming from English, while the Icelandic vocabulary would be based purely upon Icelandic roots. They are very, very chauvinistic when it comes to their language, and they refuse to allow any foreign influence to impose upon their lexicon. So this is an overall view of a very ancient family of languages, which of course only tangentially will have an effect upon Hebrew. There are Indo-European words possibly in Mikra. One of them is Barzel. Barzel, we all know, means iron. We're going to take off the lamed. Okay? This is Bet Resh Zayin. The Latin is ferrus. So the R and R are the same. We know that F and Bet will interchange. And the sibilants, Z and S, interchange. Who were the first people to use Rechem Barzel?
Egyptians?
No. Who were the first ones to use Rechem Barzel?
Babylonian.
No, in Mikra. Plishtim. And they were related to the Plishtim. The Hittites also used the Rechem Barzel. Another word would be Sus. Sus is also an Indo-European word. Now, we have the old Persian word for source, for horse, is aswas. Take off the A, helps you pronounce it, is swas. In Hebrew, the V, the W, which is consonantal, becomes a vowel, sus. Instead of sus, it's swas. So we have the influence of Indo-European upon Hebrew. And we have a very famous story, which I'm sure we're familiar with, in the Birchat Yaakov. We have Shimon v'Levi achim klei hamas mecherotehim, right? And what does Rashi say about the word mechera? Milashon yavan, mecheros kmo cherev. So Rashi brings the possibility that the word mechera might come from the ancient Greek language. Where he received this tradition from, we don't know. But there are scholars today who believe that there was contact between the ancient Hebrews and the Greeks, the Mycenaean Greeks, probably as early as the 14th, 15th century BCE, which means prior to the Mosaic period, that the Greeks made their way into Palestine, into Canaan. Of course, the Plishtim, which Abraham and Yitzhak are dealing with, the Plishtim, they originally came from the Aegean Sea region. So maybe these words entered into the Hebrew language via the Plishtim. As we've said many, many times, there's more we don't know than we do know. And as you uncover something, the more you uncover, the more fascinating it becomes, because it opens another door of knowledge which we discover. Any questions on this Indo-European material? Any questions? Yes.
No. I lost something in between there. What's the other one? Oh, where does the Greek fit in?
No, Greek is an Indo-European language.
It is an Indo-European.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Greek, Latin. Yes, definitely.
They're all. Okay.
Right. Now, I'm not speaking about the Mishnaic. 1 minute. I'm not speaking about the Mishnaic period and the Talmudic period, where there are many, many Greek and Latin loan words that enter Hebrew.
Right.
We're speaking about an earlier period now.
You're not talking Aramaic. You're talking
about
Greek.
No.
Okay.
Question.
No, this suggests Indian.
Yeah, of course. The Sanskrit.
Yeah.
The most ancient Indian language.
Mm-hmm.
The Sanskrit language, which is probably going back to 1200 or 1300 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
They say that, you know, there's a story told that if a Sanskrit priest spoke his language today, he would be understood by a Lithuanian. Because Lithuanian language, although the earliest written documents are maybe only 1,000 years old, the Lithuanian language, which is an Indo-European language, is as conservative in structure as Sanskrit would have been 3,000 years ago. In other words, the sound system and the grammar has not changed.
Excuse me, Professor. Egyptian, is that precursor to Arabic, or is it not?
Egyptian, hieroglyphic Egyptian?
Yes.
Okay, you have to wait about 10 minutes, or less.
I'll be here.
What?
I'll wait here.
Okay.
Sanskrit, I thought that was only the written picture rather than a verbal. Was that a verbal language?
It was considered to be the sacred language. The priests would use that language.
Spoken only by the priests, in other words.
I'm not I have enough trying to... Okay, to zero in on this. There are people who are experts on the what we call South Asian languages. Will be today Urdu and the Hindi, you know, and there are probably 250 languages spoken in the Indian subcontinent. Yes?
You started speaking of Sanskrit.
Sanskrit is the ancient language of India.
Yeah.
It was about 1200 BCE. It's the language of their ancient epics, the Rig Veda. Yes?
And what is its contribution?
No, it has no contribution other than it being a very ancient Indo-European language.
I haven't seen any Indian words yet, in English or in Hebrew.
Pajama. Pajama is an Indian word.
Okay.
Also, dungaree. Those are Indian words.
Well, that's the more common.
Yeah, the last 200 years.
Yeah.
Right.
But it has earned a place in the name, in the classification.
Without a doubt.
European.
Well, we say Indo-European... the Persian languages also, and Indo-European, would fit into somewhere in between the East and West families. Because the vocabulary, there is the vocabulary and the structure of Persian bears an amazing similarity to Hindi and Urdu. Uh-huh. So if a person knows Persian very, very well, yeah, if it's their native language, and I was speaking Urdu or Hindi, which are really the same language, although one is written in Arabic script and one is written in their own native script, I would be able to understand much of what they're saying. The same way, if I know Russian very, very well, I could pick up a Polish newspaper and make out about 60 or 70% of it, even if I can't speak the language.
Mm-hmm. The recent words was done at a lexicon written by somebody, I don't recall the name. He wanted to show that English derives from Hebrew.
Right, I've seen that.
Yeah,
it's a rather heavy book.
10,000.
Well, you know, there's always, if you go online, you'll find there's a lexicon. I forget who the scholar was who wrote it. It says that the Irish language also has many, many roots that relate to Semitic. The reason for this is that because, we have a stereotypical picture of an Irish an Irishman or an Irish woman, that they have red hair and freckles. But in terms of DNA, studies that are being done now, that the true Irishman or Irish woman lives on the west coast of Ireland. They have light skin and black hair, and they originally come from Central Asia. And their sentences are structured where the verb comes first, much like Hebrew and Arabic. So there are scholars who are working on many things. The idea is, and I was discussing this with a friend of mine this morning, it's better to be conservative and move slowly rather than trying to overthrow the apple cart in one fell swoop. Because by being conservative, you gather all your information, and then you come to a possible conclusion. There are people who like to overturn everything, and create a wave. And there might be some validity to what they have to say, but not usually. That's my opinion.
So we all originated from one location.
Linguistically speaking.
Okay, so had a different language emerge besides from moving to different locations, spreading out? Had a different...
Well, I can't tell you exactly how different languages emerge, except for the fact that, based upon what this gentleman said, there have been studies made that there is a basic sound to a core number of words in many language families in the world. But certain words will enter into a language at different times in its development due to the experience those people have in reacting to that object. So, for example, an obvious example would be har in Hebrew versus jabal in Arabic. And in Babylonian, it's shagu. So we have these three words all reacting to the same thing. It means that the experience of mountain, maybe the word mountain in Babylonian and the word mountain in Hebrew, in the earliest stages of the language, the word har, the root word, which maybe is lost to us today, may have meant something, while shadu may have meant something in Babylonian as mountain, but in the Hebrew language, as the gentleman may have said, Shaddai meant he of the mountain. The development, the semantic development of words is at a different stage in different languages. Or I'll give you another example. The word natsar in Hebrew, to watch, like notser, and nazara in Arabic, to see. Basically, it's the same shoresh, but the semantic range of the word is different. They go and they diverge at a certain point. Or the word sipor in Hebrew is a bird, but safir in Arabic is a canary. But osfur is a bird. But osfur is the same word as sipor, but has an ayin in the front. So when you dip into a lexicon to find words, you have to dip very, very carefully. I've learned the hard way that etymology is sometimes a folk etymology, and they really have no bearing on what the actual word means. One of my great teachers was Moshe Held. And Moshe Held was one of the greatest Semitic scholars in the 20th century. He taught Hebrew and Babylonian language in Columbia University. And he used to say, your most important role is to understand what we have in front of us. And use that very well. And when you understand what you have in front of you very well, then you are there listening to Yirmiyah. Then you are there listening to Yeshayahu. Then you are there getting the Aseret HaDibrot. To understand that daf, that pasuk, that milah, completely, is more important than going through everything and just saying it as if it were just sounds. Any more questions on this subject before we move on? Okay. So we are interested in particular in Hebrew. And Hebrew, as we all know, belongs to the Semitic family of languages. And we are familiar with the term Semite. Unfortunately, we're familiar with the term anti-Semite. The word Semite itself derives from the word Shem, one of the ancestors of Avraham Avinu. When we look at the term Semite from a linguistic point of view, Semitic languages, we're speaking about a rather broad family of languages, approximately 70 separate languages in written history have been part of this vast family. And the most ancient of this family of languages is sometimes called the Assyrian language, sometimes called the Babylonian language, and sometimes called the Akkadian language. And needless to say, we're dealing with three cities and two civilizations, the Ashur, Babel, and Akkad. Of these three, the grammar is substantially the same in all three, the vocabulary substantially the same in all three. The oldest manifestation would be Akkadian, going back to approximately 2500 BCE, would be more or less contemporary with Avraham Avinu, as we understand Avraham Avinu's time today. The Assyrian, Babylonian, and Akkadian language is a spoken language from 2400 BCE down until about 135 CE. The last tablets were written on metal tablets. They were astronomical tablets. I don't remember if they were written in... I think they were written in Babel. But of course there was no Babel then. It was part of the Greek Empire at that time. They did not write an alphabet. They wrote in a cuneiform system. It's called in Hebrew the Ketava Yekedot. Okay, I'll give you several examples. This is approximately what the cuneiform system looked like. It's called wedge writing. It was written on clay. It's a rather cheap commodity. You find it along the riverbank. And the scribe, the sofer, he would use a device somewhat looking like a good humor stick with a hook at the end, and he would press in the soft clay, press these various combinations of wedges. There are about 650 different combinations of wedges. About 150 of them are common, and the rest were used only on occasion. What makes this system of writing different than the alphabetic system of writing is that this was syllabic. So this would be ka as a syllable. This would be either an or il. Some of them have more than one possibility. And needless to say, when you combine these signs, you come up with a word. So let me give you an example of what this language sounded like. I'll give you two of the laws from the Hammurabi Code. Shumma mar avishu imtahas ritishu inakisu. Which means, I'll say it again. Shumma mar avishu imtahas ritishu inakisu. If a boy hits his father, his hand shall be cut off. Now let's take it slowly. Shumma, shema, Mishnaic term. Shumma mar. Mar is like mar, but it doesn't mean a man. It means a boy in this case. Abishu, aviv, abishu, imtahas, machatz, like machatz motnei, motnayim kama min yikumun. Ritishu, there's no word in Hebrew. Ritishu inakisu, yikaret, tikaret actually. His hand shall be cut off. A second one. Shumma awilum, awilam, me'ertu elishu idima, la'uktiishu, awilam shu'u idda'at. That's a very difficult one. Okay, shumma awilam, awilum, if a man, me'ertu, that means an accusation, elishu, alav, idima, nada, to throw, La ukti ishu, he can't make it nahon. Okay, awilam shu'u, ha'isha ze idda'ak. Now that's related etymologically, not semantically, to dakak, to pulverize him. In this case, he shall be put to death. If a man accuses another man of a crime, a capital crime now, and cannot prove it, that man is put to death. Why? Because he has to raise his hand before the gods and take an oath. And if you raise your hand before the gods and you can't prove it, you're put to death. So that's an idea of how the Hammurabi Code sounded. Of course, the Hammurabi Code, much like we have the Ayin Tahat Ayin and Shin Tahat Shin, and we're all taught in high school that's a very cruel thing and very inhuman and humane and cruel. Really, it's not. Because what it means is that the hand and the leg and the eye and the arm of the commoner is just as good as the king's. And if the king does something wrong to you, the common person, and he did something to you in an unjust way, the king is subject to the same punishment that the commoner is subject to. But that's off our topic. Okay. So, go ahead.
I'm fascinated on how we interpret this. How do we know that this is what that says?
Because we have syllabaries. Syllabaries mean that the scribes have given us handbooks with the whole sound system spelled out for us of these languages. There are people today, and I'm not one, who could read a Babylonian tablet at 50 paces as well as you can read the New York Post. It's unbelievable what they can do. I remember being in the British Museum one time. In the British Museum, there's one room. It's called the cuneiform tablet room. And the guys take boxes, shoe boxes of tablets, and put them on a table and just look through them, and they pick it up and start reading it. It's amazing. And most of your tablets are rather prosaic. They're economic tablets. But every once in a while you find an unbelievable literary tablet. And sometimes you're in the British Museum and you find a half of a literary tablet, and the other half might be in the museum, the Topkapi Museum in Turkey. And one scholar doesn't know what the other scholar has. Okay, so that's the most ancient of the Semitic languages. This is an East Semitic language, because in Babel, it's in the eastern part of what we call the Middle East. Then we have, of course, I'm going in chronological order, chronological development. We have the Ugaritic. Ugaritic was discovered in 1929. Like many discoveries in the Middle East, Ugaritic was discovered. The town of Ugarit was discovered by an Arab who happened to be digging in the ground, and his shovel hit something hard, and it turned out to be a door to a city. And they uncovered this vast city with hundreds and hundreds of tablets. And Ugaritic was written also in cuneiform, but cuneiform that wasn't syllabic. It was alphabetic. In other words, it was just one of these for one letter. No vowels were written. About 1400 BCE, right.
That's
But some of the tablets go back a little bit earlier, maybe 1650 BCE. Then we have Aramaic. And of course, Aramaic, there are different types of Aramaic. Aramaic is the oldest Semitic language still spoken today. I had a student in my class who came from Kurdistan, and his grandparents spoke Aramaic. That was their spoken language. Still spoken today. And we say Hebrew, of course, is a very ancient language, but for quite a few years, centuries, it wasn't really a spoken language. It was a written language. But Aramaic has been a spoken language for many, many, many centuries. Then we have what we call Hebrew. Did the Bible, however, call it Hebrew? Well, let's take a look at a few passages and see, in fact, what the Bible may have called Hebrew. There's a very, very famous passage. Okay, there's a very famous passage in Menachem Beit, which is, "Vayomer Eliakim ben Hilkiyahu v'shivna v'yoach el Rav Shake." Rav Shake is the chief butler. Rav Shake. It's a Babylonian title. Rabbo Shakuk. "Daber nai el avadecha aramit, ki shom'im anachno, v'al tedaber imanu yehudit, v'ozne ha'am, asher ala homa." So the Hebrews, the Jews, are asking the Babylonian, "Speak with us in Aramaic, because people around us understand Yehudit. Don't speak with us in Jewish. Speak with us in Aramaic." And then we have another very, very interesting passage here. It's in Yeshayahu. "Bayomahu yihyu hamesh arim be'eretz Mitzrayim midabrot sifat kena'an." Does not mention Hebrew. The first time we have the word Hebrew being mentioned is in the Gemara, especially in Masechet Gittin. We have the problem of the get, which is a mixed language get. We have Yevanit and Ivrit. Is that get a kosher get? Which is not a problem for us tonight. It's a problem for a rabbi to discuss. But here we have the language Ivrit being mentioned. There's also the language Ivrit being mentioned in the... It's not anywhere part of our literature. It's mentioned in the book of Revelation, the final book in the Christian Bible. And it speaks about the Sifat Ever, the language of Ever. So it seems that the term Ivrit, not like Abraham Ivri or with Yonah, Ivri Anochi, the term was used in a gentilic sense in Nikra, being applied to a person as to his place of origin, but not referring to a particular language. The language family was Sifat Kina'an. What other languages belong to Sifat Kina'an? We have Moabit, Moabitic. We have Ammonit, Ammonitic. Edomit, the Edomite language. And Pinikit, Phoenician. And Punit, Punic. Plus what we call Ivrit today. The question is, when we speak about Hebrew, is the Hebrew today, as it's pronounced today, the same as it was pronounced during the time of Mikra? Well, I'm going to read something to you, and you will answer it for yourselves. Okay, and I'll have to find it now. This is in Sefer Shoftim Shirat Devorah. Sham yitanu sitkot Hashem. I'll say Sham is in the Pasuk Yud Aleph. Sham yitanu sitkot Hashem. Yitanu with a tav. Now that should call. If anyone is an expert on the Mahzor, whether it's the Ashkenazi Mahzor, is a very famous prayer said before Musaf Unetane Tokef. Mm-hmm. Now, Yitanu is the same as Yishane, to repeat, to call to mind. To call to mind Shem Yishanu Sitkot Hashem. The question arises, why does the poet write it with a tav, not a shin? The answer is that the Hebrew language, the Hebrew alphabet, as you'll see when I give out the sheet to you, had 22 letters. And these 22 letters were incapable of actually reproducing every sound that the Hebrews used. So, for example, something which is not even mentioned here, we have the city much in the news today, the area called Gaza. Gaza. How do you say Gaza in Hebrew? Azza. Azza with the ayin, Azza. But if you look in the Greek, the Targum HaShivim, they spell it with a gim. Gaza. Gaza. Why? Because they're trying to reproduce a sound which no longer is used in Hebrew, ra'in, as in Arabic, Gaza. Gaza. Then you have Sodom, in English, Sodom and Gomorrah. Why do we have Sodom and Gomorrah? In Hebrew is Amora, because it's reproducing a sound which no longer exists. In Arabic it's written with a rayin. Sodom wa Amora, Ramora. So these sounds were evidently being used in Hebrew 2,000 years ago or more, but there was not a letter to reproduce those sounds. So here we have an example of this. Another example. Here we have an example at the end of the Shiat Devorah. Mayim Shal Halav Natana B'Sefer Adirin Hikriva Hem'ah Yadda Layate Tishlachna V'mina Lahalmut Amelim V'halma Sisra Mahaka V'dakuf Mahaka Rosho. And then, in the second half, Umahatsa, like Mahats. So mahak, mahatz, because the sound of the sadi at that time was somewhere in between the sadi and makof. And you know, of course, in later Aramaic, the kof, like arka in Sefer Yirmiyah, arka becomes ara with the ayin. So the sound changes, the sounds of letters. At times these sounds could not be reproduced. We have the famous Melech, Hiskiyahu. You say Hiskiyahu, you pronounce it the Sephardi Het, Hiskiyahu. But when you read his name in the Kitab HaYetedot, there's a very famous section that parallels Sefer Yeshayahu and speaks about the siege of Jerusalem. And I remember having to memorize part of it. And he spoke about Chazakiyahu Shar Yahudaya La Iknushu Anna Neriya. Ramelech Hiskiyahu Lo Nichna Leoli. So a Chazakiyahu, like a Chaf. So evidently, the Het in Hebrew, at least during the biblical period, that one letter, het, probably had a double pronunciation, which the Hebrews, like we know when there's a soft G and a hard G. We know that. We know we grew up with it in English. So evidently the ancient Hebrews knew when to pronounce it het and when to pronounce it het. I'll give you one more example. We know that one of Shlomo HaMelech and David HaMelech's best friends was Hiram. Who was Hiram? He's a king. Okay, he lived in what is today Lebanon. And his name is written...
Hiram.
Right. His name is written like this. With the comments. And then you look in Sefer Melachim, and it speaks over here, Vayat Hiram, Hiram, with a holam male. What does that bring to mind? It brings to mind the Temani pronunciation, where they would say instead of Mata, Mator, where the Kamas is pronounced like a holam, an O, or the Ashkenazi pronunciation. I remember I had a teacher many years ago in Yeshiva University, rightly or wrongly, he is to maintain that the Ashkenazi pronunciation of Hebrew had primacy over the Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew. Why was that? Because he maintained that in the Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew today, they don't differentiate between the Tav, the Gusha, and the Tav Bilti de Gusha. They make it both Tav, when it really should be Tav and Fav, like the Temanim. And then he maintained, of course, that in the northern part of Israel, in the Galil, they pronounce Hebrew as the Ashkenazim do today, which there is some truth to that. Because you find in when the Hebrew language, when the ta'amim and the vocalic system was being developed, it's called the Masorah. There were two schools of Masorah. There was the Masorah that was the Palestinian Masoretic school and the Babli Masoretic school. And sometimes they pronounce the Kamet as an O, Sahurayim, Chochmah. Or when it's a closed syllable, Ochlam, Shochbecha. We know that from our own pronunciation. But they argued how these two words should be pronounced. We have Bayit and Batim. Now in modern Hebrew it's Batim with the commas. But they argued it should be Botim. And then the word Yam and Yamim, Yomim. They couldn't decide what was the correct pronunciation because evidently there were two masorot of how to pronounce the kamat in that particular, in these particular words. Yeah.
That was also a question?
That was also a question, right.
Okay.
Yomam. Your man, right. Interestingly enough, I know very little about the Yiddish language, almost nothing, in terms of its grammar, but the word Yad, Yad is written with the commas, but it's always pronounced in Yiddish with a fatah. Ah, Yad, tamid, without exception. Never say Yod. So there's a great deal that has to be done on the history of the phonetics of the Hebrew language. Let me give out these sheets, and we can go over these. Just take one and pass it around, and then I'll start with the other one in the back. We'll come forward.
Professor, if words like Gaza and Gomorrah were pronounced with the hook, and but not written that way,
right?
Continually pronounced past the writing,
right?
Would lead a number of conclusions. Obviously, that writing is far much later, and things have kept on being passed on verbally,
right?
Acoustically, but then even in more recent times, it still has not gone to the writing portion.
You mean to reproduce the sound?
What I'm thinking of is some English words that had gone from acoustic to written, and then from written, since it was written differently, now, like a waistcoat, or which is waistcoat.
Right.
But they wrote it waistcoat.
Right.
So now we pronounce it waistcoat.
Because, you see, what happens is, and this is a whole different subject, Languages come in contact with each other for a prolonged period of time. One language will have a definite effect upon the sound system of the other language. So after 1066, and the conquest of England by France, William of Normandy, the introduction of the old French language, or if you have it, vulgar Latin, into the English language will have a debilitating effect upon the sound system of English, and also upon the vocabulary. It's the introduction of many, many Latin roots. And also the sound, the harder sound, the laryngeal sound system found in old in German or Anglo-Saxon will gradually be softened. And you can see that in the development of languages, in the development of English. If you look at, for example, the oldest examples of English, if I remember correctly, there are fragments of a gospel, even the Hebrew part of the Bible, in Old English going back to the 8th century. And unless someone would read it and explain it to you, you would never recognize it as being English. It would sound more like Old Norse or Old German. Yeah, Beowulf. That's where you're right. Beowulf is Old English, definitely. What would I say? What was of the vowel system? Mordechai. Right, but you know the word they term, when you look at the word Mordechai, when you look at it etymologically, according to the rabbinic etymology, it's Mardecha, you know, pure Mord. But you know what the origin of the word is? Right. But that goes back to Mar Utuak, the son of the sun god. It goes back to an old Sumerian word. It depends how you want to vowelize it and vocalize it based upon the original pronunciation. Mar Utuak. We can't vowelize something according to another language's sound system. It's got to be according to the laws that come down to us. What we have today, basically, the sound system of Hebrew today is probably the sound system that was preserved during Bayit Sheni in Jerusalem, from the time of Ezra on. And that was the Masorah, in terms of the way we are pronouncing Hebrew, standardized Hebrew. What was pronounced in the surrounding area in the Galil in the south of Jerusalem, we only have city Din. Let's look at this inscription. This is a very old inscription, which is now, I believe, in the museum in Turkey. It was found about the year 1865-1870 in the Shiloh, in the tunnel outside of Jerusalem. The tunnel is still there. You go in there, it fills up with water, you know, they take you on a tour through that tunnel. And there's an aqueduct, right? And this is an example of different alphabetic, development of alphabet from the earliest Semitic writing right down to the present day. And here we have the inscription. Now let's read the inscription together. The first word is a reconstruction, tam, being it's complete. Ha nikba, it's an opening of some kind, nakav. Vizehaya devara nikba, ba'od, hagarzen, ish el re'ehu. Ube'od shalosh amot lehin nakev, kol ish kore el re'ehu. Ki hayeta zida. That word does not appear in Mikra. No one knows what the word zida means. It could be some kind of an obstruction that had to be removed. Ki hayeta zida batsur liyamin uvayam hanikva hiku hachotzvim ish vikrot re'eho garzen ar garzen vayirhu hamayim min hamotza. El abrecha b'matayim ve'elef ama, and the next way, oh no, me'at ama hayeta gova hatsur al rosh ha'chotzvim. So here's a very, very interesting inscription, and if you notice, you look at the script above, all the letters seem to run together. That makes it very difficult, because without being a trained scribe, you'd find it very difficult even to have these modern Hebrew letters, if they all ran together. And you had to separate them very quickly. Unless you knew your Hebrew language very, very well, it would be really nigh on impossible to do that. So the inscription here, the letters are really running together, except for an occasional nikuda, which separates words. You have an occasional nikuda if you look very carefully. That isn't a mark from the printer. There isn't a small nikuda on this on the inscription.
Between each
one. Yes, some of the words. Now, there was a study made of this inscription by the Hebrew University, not in terms of the shape of the letters, in terms of its age. There are people who don't only deny that the Holocaust occurred, but they deny the authenticity of inscriptions. And what they try to do is they try to compress the history of the Hebrew language into a very, very small period of time. And what the scholars in the biology department did, they gathered a sample of moss from this inscription. Of course, the moss was no longer alive, but the Siridim were there, and they subjected this moss to a carbon test and a DNA test, and they found out, number one, that the moss there in the inscription, the remains of the moss, was consistent with the moss that existed in the land of Israel. Not only then, but now. And the carbon test demonstrated that the inscription would date give or take a few years, far from the time, about 680 to 85 BCE, which would be consistent with Hiskiyahu's reign. So this is one of the earliest examples of inscriptions we have found of the Hebrew language. Unfortunately, the epigraphic remains of Hebrew are not that widespread. We have many, many seals with names on it. One of the seals that was found rather recently had the name of Baruch on it, the servant of Yirmiyah, of Yirmiyah. Another inscription was found, and it's still being studied, which has the first mention of David, the house of David. There are people, what they call non-biblical detractors, who are maintaining that David HaMelech never existed. What does this do for us? Well, the most important thing it does for us, it shows us the antiquity of the Hebrew language. And it shows us that the tradition of the Hebrew language goes back into a pre-biblical period. The earliest traces of pre-biblical Hebrew would date from the 15th century BCE. Now, I want to read these examples of pre-biblical Hebrew for you, and they come from a series of tablets called the El Amarna tablets. They were found in El Amarna in Egypt about the year 1880. They're written in Babylonian. They're written to the kings of Egypt, three or four kings of Egypt, and the small minor rulers of Canaan at that time. Here we have the word, and remember, the Babylonian syllabic system cannot always reproduce a letter sound. But certain words do not exist in Babylonian, certain letters. There was no ayin in Babylonian. There was no rayin in Babylonian. There was no ha, light hek in Babylonian. So what is Yazkur? Yazkuru is Yizkor. Zuruchu, Zroa. Shachra, Shachru, Sha'ar. Batnu. With a tet, Batnu, Betim. Which king is Chomri. Chulu is all, like all Malchut Shamayim. Chafru is Afar. And Chazatu, which city is Chazatu? Gaza. So here we have the earliest examples of the Hebrew language, or the Canaanite language, if you would have that term being used, in the pre-biblical period. So we find that there's a definite development of Hebrew. Now, how does that relate to Avraham Avinu? Last week, one of the members of the audience asked me, what language did Avraham Avinu speak? And of course, it's very, very difficult to ascertain. He may have spoken many languages. He may have spoken Sumerian. He may have spoken Hittite. He had to speak to Ephron HaPeti, after all. But he also may have spoken an ancestor of Hebrew, which we now call Eblaitic. What is Eblaitic? Tel Marduk in Syria was uncovered in 1970 approximately, by an Italian archaeological team, Giovanni Fortunato and Paolo Matitia. And he uncovered many, many tablets, hundreds of tablets. Very few of them have been published entirely. Among those tablets is one of them which mentions the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, the first mention of the two cities of the plain outside of the Bible. But what's also very important about these tablets, at least the information we've been able to cull, is that many of the names in these tablets are West Semitic. West Semitic meaning ancestors of the Hebrew people. I wouldn't say ancestors of the Jews, but linguistically speaking, definitely our ancestors. Perhaps and almost certainly not religiously speaking, but most certainly linguistically speaking. It was in Tel Marduk in Syria.
Where is that?
I really don't know exactly, but you can look up Ebla in any of the more recent encyclopedias, it will tell you.
Okay.
Now, what does this do for us? What it does for us is it shows us a linguistic continuity. from remote antiquity, from possibly the mid-third millennium BCE, right down until the end of the biblical period, approximately the 5th century BCE, into the early proto-Mishnaic period, into the Mishnaic period, into the period of the Tosafot, into the period of Gemara, where the Hebrew language was in a state of constant development and redevelopment. And how did it develop and redevelop? By absorbing from the vocabulary of the surrounding nations around it. It absorbed the Greek language, it absorbed the Latin language, it absorbed elements of the Persian language in order to enrich its own vocabulary. Now I'm going to close just with one example of a word in Mishnah which is not mentioned in Mikra at all, but it really should be, because it's a very common word for a farmer, and that is the word for a rooster. It's Tarnagol. Now, do you know Tarnagol is not a Hebrew word? Tarnagol is an old Sumerian word. Tarn, the bird, Lugal, of the king. Lu is man, Gal is big. The bird of the king, which was the peacock, was the bird of the king, like the peacock throne of the Shah of Iran. So here we have a word which probably goes back to hoary antiquity, to the Sumerian period, maybe 3000 BCE, and it makes its way down slowly but surely into the language of Mishnah. Not in the Bible at all. Well, thank you very much, and hope to continue. Yes?
I have questions I got to ask you, but I'm sorry I got to ask.
Go ahead.
Two words that I don't know the reason, what they are, that we use all the time, Amen, which I thought might come from Amon, the Egyptian, and also Aton to Adonai,
relationship. No. Adonai has a relationship to Adonis.
Really?
Yes. Adonis is, there's a definite connection between those two.
Okay.
Being Lord or Master. But not in a religious sense.
Amen.
Amen is like saying Ebona, Emet. It's true. Emet and Amen are the same.
Okay.
Because if you say Amiti, or you have a Dagesh in the Tav, and the Dagesh in the Tav is the Havla'at Nun, the Nun is assimilated. So it's like you say Amen, say when you're in the Kaddish, for example, say Amen is Emet, it's true.
Okay. It's a direct linguistic.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Tohu and Bohu don't sound
hebraic. They are. I'm not going to discuss the etymology. Tahiyah is a very rare Arabic word. It means like an empty wasteland. So that would be the etymological relationship to Tohu. Bohu, I don't know of any etymology. But these are what we call this Shtelilim Muvan Ehad. The two words, the Chesed Be'emet, Tov V'Yashar. The two words, many, many times in Hebrew you find two words coming together. They are linked by a conjunction. The two words mean the same thing. Yes?
The word Shem, as the right from Shuma.
Yeah, that was said by Samuel Noah Kramer, one of his books, many years ago.
No, I just wanted to continue. So, hey, Hebrew today means he doesn't know the answer. It's the mystery.
Aha. Aha. Right. It could be. You have a question? Go ahead. Sally, go ahead. Okay, I'll try to answer that question a bit soon. The Lashon HaMishnah will really be another lecture. If you're in the mood for another one. Lashon HaMishnah was probably the vernacular, the spoken language, while the Lashon HaMikra was the written language, okay, and they existed side by side The Lashon HaMishnah did not make its way into Mikra except for Mila, Kabbalah Milim, Bodadot. You know, every once in a while you find maybe the scribe would slip and put in his spoken language rather than written language. And obviously, in a vernacular tongue, in a spoken language, the rules of grammar are not going to be that strict because the language is being spoken by people who don't really pay attention to grammar. If you look at the written Arabic, it's very, very midakdik. It's very exact. But the Ameya, the spoken language, whether it's Egyptian spoken or Moroccan or any of the spoken dialects, they're really not that strict when it comes to Zachar and Nekevah. And the same thing is probably true of the development of the Hebrew. The Mishnah will be the spoken language. And eventually, of course, the written language becomes only sifruti, only for writing, and it's kept alive artificially by the rabbis for many centuries, and the spoken language becomes the language of Mishnah, and eventually has to go into writing too. One more question. Go ahead.
Why words like Aviron
change words like Shikosh? Well, the word Aviron, it comes from the old Greek word. Avir. Aura, he has an air of beauty about her. An aura, it's really not a Hebrew word. It's borrowed into Hebrew. Go ahead, you're next.
I noticed how in Chesky's scroll text, they use the, I guess you would say, Aramaic Hebrew type of letters,
yeah.
But then when it came to God's name, it had the ancient.
Right.
So what was that? Is that
probably
like
because it would indicate they wouldn't want to pronounce it according to the Tetragrammaton. They pronounce it as like a shim. Of course, you know that during the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the ancient Hebrew script was revived. And then, of course, when the rebellion failed, that was the end of that. And likewise, I might say that the Phoenicians in North Africa did the same thing. That they revived during the period of Hannibal. When Hannibal rebelled against Rome, he was a Phoenician, actually. I mean, Hani Baal, the grace of Baal. And they revived the ancient Phoenician script. And then, of course, when they were defeated, their script developed, many Latin words crept in, and the whole phonetic system just broke down till the language disappeared completely. Go ahead.
And last, I've got coming out to modern Israel. When the state started, they changed. They adopted basically Sephardic.
A modified Sephardic pronunciation.
Yeah, but based on what did they change the grammar? Like Kita in Tanakh, they put it and made it Kita.
Well, that's because when you're writing without Nikud, you have to have the Motakriya to help people read it. So you introduce the Imota Kriya, introduce the Yud and the Ale and the Vav, and help people read. But when you're writing a newspaper, it's Dilki Dikud.
That's the only change they made?
No, the other change is, well, you know, there was a very great scholar with whom I studied, Moshe Gottstein.
Yes.
The great Mechanech in Israel, he's a great scholar, expert in Aramaic. He once made a statement, which I don't agree with, but I'll tell you what his statement was anyway, just to annoy all of us, including myself. He said that the Hebrew language is nothing but an Indo-European language with Hebrew letters. Now, if we can move down eventually into modern Hebrew, I'll show you how that's really wrong. But nonetheless, what he was possibly trying to say is that to communicate with the outside world, you can't adopt a biblical tense system today, being imperfect and perfect, as all the Hebrew Bible really has. There's no present, past, and future. And the flexibility of the verbal system was allowed to develop over so many centuries, where Hebrew today is really understood the same as French, Spanish, English is today. One more question. I'm really tired, Howie. In the car.
It evolved the same way the English that we speak today evolved. We're not speaking in the way they did 200 years
right.
ago. We're not writing the same way. And slang gets into our writing, into the newspapers the same way.
You know, I'll tell you something.
It's really an evolution.
Even to give a lecture on the Hebrew language,
right.
Back in the 1930s, I know this for a fact because one of my teachers at NYU was caught up in this battle of getting the New York City Board of Education to accept Hebrew as a modern language. And the first school to accept Hebrew as a modern language and offer Hebrew in the high school system was Abraham Lincoln High School. No other school in the city would allow it. And now, if you see that Hebrew is dying, where maybe the only school of notice school that offers Hebrew and tries to keep it alive is a school like Peter Stuyvesant. And even there they have a problem because they can't get teachers
because
teaching Hebrew.
Because the role in yeshivas. That's why
right.
They don't have the people. They don't have the persons. But Lafayette also had it, so to speak.
I went to Lafayette, I know.
They both had it.
Okay, Harry, you get the last question. I'll give you the opportunity. Oh, yeah, first my son. Yes, you go. Sophie letters? I've never seen any use of the Sophie letters prior to the Dead Sea Scroll period. Though, in all honesty, there was an article written many years ago by Naftali Tur Sinai, who was one of the great Hebrew scholars, and the whole article was on the mergers of and development of the Sophie letters. I think he said that in the article, but I really can't tell you for certain.
Well, the Gemara says, Mantafach Sofim Amarun. Mantafach.
Right.
Sofim Amarun is rabbis.
I know, that's what my son said also. We were speaking about that last week.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Hebrew inscriptions, in the old Hebrew script, there are no Sofim letters.
Yeah. Yeah, because the rabbis.
Right, the rabbis.
Yeah, how about the Dead Sea Scroll? They don't have Sofim?
I think they do.
But they printed then there's a problem. Then it's... It predates
the rabbis. Well, I would have to look online and see if they have the Sophic letters. Okay?
Sophic doesn't mean that. Sophic means prophet.
Prophet.
Sophic means prophet.
So that's okay.
And anachronistic. No,
probably later. The prophetic period ends in the 5th century, 4th century BCE.
Okay.
That would be a little bit early for the Dead Sea Scrolls, so that would correspond with that. Mm-hmm. Last question.
Of the words that appear in the Humash, roughly what percentage can be traced back to the...
The what? The Greek?
No, Akkadian.
Sanvedim is can be traced back to Akkadian because it's a... it comes the shortest is Nur Shanwaru. Shanwaru means... They make a very bright light. Shanwaru.
So I said, but of all the words that appear in the Humash, what percentage can we trace back to Akkadian? Roughly half, one quarter, a third?
I would rather say that there are many words in the Humash that are traced back to common Semitic rather than Akkadian. There are certain verbal patterns like that appear like mitaleh or mitapechet. To be continually revolving, that verbal form, it would be a development of an Akkadian verbal pattern, which does not appear in later biblical Hebrew. The Eid Ya'aleh, Eid, Aleph Dalit. That might even be a pre-Akkadian word, Idu, will be like a mist that's arising from the ground, or a water flow from the earth. I mean, you're asking me a question that I have to use a computer actually and find the answer. There are people who rather trace ideas from Babel or Akkad rather than words, because the vocabulary does cut across horizontally, and there's a common Semitic vocabulary. I don't think there are that many words. The word kise would be a Sumerian word coming from guza, going into Akkadian kusu, going into Hebrew kise. The word hechal is not appearing in Melachim, like hechal. It's egal, e being bayit, gal being big. Egal, hechal. In the Mishnah, it's speaking of adrikal. Adrikal is ward, eved, wadrikal, eved hahechal. Even the name of Metushelach. Metushelach is Matu Ish Shelach. Shelach. Matu Shelach. Ish
Tahmoshe, the man of the armor, the man of the weapon.
Eden
Maiden, Idu, Idinu. Metushael, the man of God. Metushael. So these are examples of words that come from Akkadit, or names that come from Akkadit. Lo Yadon Rohi Bahim. Maybe Yadanu, to dwell with, rather than Nadan. Although Radak makes a valiant effort to understand it in his Perush on Chumash.
How about something about Paneya?
That's Egyptian. So it's Pinhas, the Egyptian name. Mira. Yes, it's Egyptian. Can you uncover secrets? Yeah, it's pretty much a translation, Minuli, from Egyptian, but the Egyptian name. Mm-hmm. Now the Egyptian Rekha of the Sipur of Yosef has been already done by many, many great scholars in terms of vocabulary and the atmosphere that's there. It's really done beautifully. It's, in Islam, it's the only story found in Quran, the story of Surat Yusuf. Go ahead. Last question, then I have to stop. Why? Well, there are purists in Israel today who will not use them. They'll use Zikayon for television instead of television. I remember many years ago, I remember going to the Hebrew University, and there was a fellow I spoke to, first name was Uzi, I forget his last name. Do you remember his last name? He was a professor of philology. He said he was not a Hebrew, he was a Kana'anim. And the Kana'anim, they would only use the pure, pure Semitic words. They wouldn't use any milim lo aziyot. As I mentioned before, you know, the English language has had an all-embracing influence upon the entire world. You go anywhere in the world, in Western Europe, or in the Southern Europe, or parts of the Middle East, and you find telephone and radio, even in the Arabic language, which is supposed to be a pure language, you find in the first chapter in Quran, you find a Latin word, sirat. Sirat al-mustaqim, the straight path, is from strata, old Latin word meaning a path. So there are no languages really, or very few languages that have not had the effect of the outside, taking in a milim lo aziyot. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm
going to
just
tell you,
the other one from Latin, from German.
Of course.
Only Americans would have